Deputy Speaker, I beg to move that this House do now adjourn.
The question is, that this House do now adjourn, Mrs. Margaret Thatcher. Yeah.
Mr. Deputy Speaker, whatever view the Prime Minister may take about the situation in Britain, the opposition took the view that we were in a position of grave trouble of crisis proportions. And I should have thought that that was no longer in doubt, and it was of such a nature and such a proportion that it would also be of great concern to the House, and that we should debate it at the earliest opportunity. The Prime Minister took a different view and, after a month's recess, was not prepared to provide a day from government time, so we provided a supply day of our own. Inquiries around the several organisations about the precise position have revealed a very grim picture indeed. The transport reports, the Freight Transport Association, which represents own account operators like supermarkets, officially they're not in dispute according to the agreement with the TGWU, and they should be exempt from picketing. They report that own account vehicles are being widely picketed. They also report that basic food supplies are being stopped. The Road Haulage Association confirms that picketing is affecting the supplies of essential goods. The Freight Transport Association also reports a new problem, shortage of diesel fuel, particularly in the southwest, because of picketing at the oil terminals at Avonmouth. British Rail report quite simply there are no trains today. And British Transport Docks, the nationalised ports sector, say that on average traffic at their ports is down 40%. Practically no containers are getting in and out of Southampton, that the rail strike has added to the burden. The report from CBI, many firms are being strangled, there's a shortage of materials, they can't move their own products, exports are being lost. They say that secondary picketing, picketing of firms not in dispute, is very heavy all over the country. There's particularly of things like salt, packaging, sugar, and all vital materials necessary of industries to keep going. Layoffs known to CBI, at least 125,000 already, expected to be 1 million by the end of the week. There are telegrams and telexes in from many companies saying that their exports are not being allowed through and that they might lose the orders forever. Messages from firms like Marks and Spencer's, last week they lost 20% of their food production, approximately £2 million. Unless secondary pickets are removed this week, we estimate 30% off production. In the last week and this week, unless there's a change, we shall not shift 50% of our exports. The food industry in particular is shambolic. There's pressure on edible oils, on yeast, on salt, on sugar, on packaging. No maize came through Tilbury yesterday. Associated Biscuits have already laid off 1,500 in Highton, 400 in Southampton, and more by the weekend. Cold stores are laying off people, and all large oil mills in Hull were picketed yesterday, except the one visited by BBC television. Mounting chaos, if that isn't mounting chaos, it is difficult to see what is. But the strikes we're experiencing today are not the only ones we've had recently. The tanker drivers, thank goodness, is over. We had the bread strike, we've had hospital strikes, we've had old strikes at old people's homes, strikes in newspapers, in broadcasting, in airports, and car strikes. Many people who thought previously that strikes were a characteristic of large firms only and that most firms were strike-free received a rather rude shock from a new piece of work by the Social Science Research Council, a government-financed body, which finds that nearly half our factories had some form of industrial conflict, stoppages, overtime bans, go slow, in the past 2 years, and nearly one-third suffered from all-out strikes. This is the picture in Britain today, and the troubles will not be over when the immediate strikes are settled. There are not only more problems in the pipeline, but many of the problems arising from the present strike will carry on for a very much longer time than the strikes themselves. Many export orders might never be regained, and companies and firms which have struggled hard to get them may have to lay off their workers. Some of these small firms, upon which Britain depends so much, may be forced into bankruptcy, and they too will have to lay off their workers. It was interesting this morning on BBC, a typical road haulage man who said, yes, he knew what he could afford. He could only survive about another 4 days because he was already losing £1,000 a day. Now, what is our approach to this grievous strike situation? Unlike the Prime Minister, we do not go round supporting strikes when we're in opposition. We never have and we never shall. These things are a weapon of the present government party, and the nation is reaping a bitter harvest from that attitude and approach which they have taken. Prime Minister will not like it, but it is pertinent that he be reminded exactly what attitude he took during phase three of the miners' strike. It's an offer approximately the same as that which the road haulage people are offering now. When the miners were being offered 16%, he said this to my predecessor: unless he has more money to put on the table, he has a bigger struggle on his hands than he has ever imagined. Mr. Heath is arguing that he is fighting inflation. Mr. Callaghan continued, that is utter drivel. The Prime Minister obviously expects the opposition not to follow his example, and indeed we shall not do so. We shall act responsibly, and he is very fortunate that we shall do so. So no one on this side will be urging the road hauliers to pay more. No one will be quoting the minimum amounts that they are paid. We are much more likely, I think, to believe the comments that we've heard on radio and television of many lorry drivers saying that their regular pay varies from £75 to £100 a week. Now, the Prime Minister's answer to all our troubles is a statistic, X percent, this year to be 5%. But we cannot have rigid pay policies forever. That is not a possible way of conducting affairs in a free country, in a country which has a great deal, much varied industry, in a country which must have its industry changing, always keeping abreast of the times, steadily one step ahead of competitors if we are to survive. It is not a possible way. What is more, it's not even possible on the way the government proposes to carry out its present policies. There is no way in which it will work. And I thought that the Lord President on television admitted that last Sunday when he had a very long interview. He pointed out that the low-paid workers were going to get far more than 5%. That had already been arranged. We know from legislation which the government has passed, Schedule 11 of the Employment Protection Act, that the workers just above the low paid can use that particular section to break through any incomes policy and to get higher pay because other people in the area are getting higher pay. The Prime Minister introduced that schedule. He introduced that legislation. It was part of the price he paid to the unions for the earlier stages of incomes policy. And he knows and we know that unless he has proper provision for differentials, for people who take the trouble to acquire extra skill and the years it takes, industry cannot be kept going because we shall not have the skilled labour we need. So his policy cannot and will not work. He said earlier this afternoon, when tackling the problem of inflation, yes, of course he believed in money supply. That, I believe, is now common ground between us. He, in fact, over the period of his government and that of his immediate predecessor, 5 years of Labour government, has debased the coinage to a greater extent than any other government for three centuries. That is not in dispute. Opinions as to how or why it came about, maybe. But he knows and I know that unless he holds the money supply, inflation will mount again. But he knows and I know that if he goes on spending money at the rate the government is at the moment, that it has to borrow the amount it has to at the moment, that his interest rates will be very, very high indeed, and that industry itself will be in very considerable trouble, which it already is. That is not the way in which to get productivity going. But he knows equally that for the real problem we face today is we've lived through quite a long period now of increasing trade union power. That period, I think, has been characterized by a series of what I would call package deals between governments and unions, in which governments have been offered certain advantages in return for certain cooperation. The trouble has been that the advantages tend to have been permanent and enshrined in legislation, and the cooperation only temporary. Yeah. In fact, the package deals got unpacked, and that happened even with some of ours, as there are a number of advantages to the unions in the Industrial Relations Act. Those persisted, and a good deal of the restraints, in fact, were abolished by the present government. And it's been a very, very unequal situation. Added to this, during that time, a time of mounting power to the trade unions, it's also been a period when we've had increasing left-wing militancy in control of the unions. So just at the time when we had... Oh, yes, we have. Oh, yes, we have, and the country knows it. The country knows it, the Right Honourable Gentleman, the Member for Highton knows it. Prime Minister knows it, and the people who are there in the unions, in the rank and file of the unions, know it too. So just at a time...
Order! Order! The Right Honourable Lady is not giving way, and the Honourable Gentleman must resume his seat. Mrs. Thatcher... Oh.
The Right Honourable Lady understand that she must be in a debate of this importance, specific to the dispute at issue, much more so than apparently she wishes to do, and that the characteristic of this dispute is that the rank and file have been balloting all the way through the piece, and it is only now that the leadership of the Transport and General Workers Union has come in to make it official and take a hand in it. That is the realities of the situation, and her arguments are pure fantasy.
The Honourable Gentleman suffers from the fact that I understand him perfectly. He knows as well as I do that perhaps one of the reasons why this strike was made official was because it was already out of control. Already out of control because of the mounting left-wing structure of that union. We've been through a period when we've had increasing trade union power. They've had unique power, and unique power requires unique responsibility. That responsibility has not been forthcoming, and therefore we are in the position in which this country finds itself today, about which there can be, in fact, no dispute. Now, we have already had a good deal of comment and argument between the two sides about the very vexed matter of picketing, which is playing an enormous part in during these particular strikes. Now, the Home Secretary had a go yesterday. Now, he had said two things with which I want to quarrel straight away. I don't like quarrelling with the Home Secretary, but he does give one a lot of opportunities in some of the things he says. He said first that apart from one difference in the law, which the government side brought in, the law on picketing has remained the same. And the difference which he said, which the government side brought in, is that you cannot now picket at a person's home. That was not brought in by the Labour Party. It was brought in by the Industrial Relations Act. It was in the 74 Act, but it was not an improvement or greater protection to people in their homes brought in by the government party. It was brought in by the Conservative Party in the 71 Act and was one of those things which, in fact, they retained. So he was wrong on that. He also said, I have no power to instruct chief constables in their duties. He has power to send round a circular to chief constables. He has power. Does he not remember the occasion when we've had debates in emergencies before, when his right honourable friend, the present Secretary of State for Education, debating with my right honourable friend, the Home Secretary, then now the right honourable member for Chipping Barnet, and she said this: "That is why I welcome, but regard as very late indeed, his," that was my right honourable friend, "circular to chief constables, which was sent out last Friday evening, giving advice on what steps they should take." Of course, and the Home Secretary should be giving advice on the present grievous picketing.
I have no power to instruct chief constables. That is what I said yesterday, and I repeat it, and the Right Honourable Lady is wrong.
Will he, in fact, give the Chief Constables advice through a circular? And why has he... And why has he not... And why has he not done so already? He has power to give advice in a circular, and he should, in view of the seriousness of the situation, already be doing it. We on this side of the House would take the view that it is far better to take emergency powers early rather than leave it until the situation has escalated. That is the practice which we took. The emergency powers were usually taken comparatively early. The negotiations with industry now should have been completed on what regulations it would be necessary to add to the corpus that is already there, ready and waiting under the Emergency Powers Act of 1920. I doubt whether these steps have been taken, and I think that is why he is not bringing in emergency powers as it is now. There's no need, when you've got them in, suddenly to use the army. They are there if the contingency plans have all been properly made. Now, may I continue on the law on picketing? Apart from the one change to which he referred, which we made, he's quite right in saying that the law on the nature of picketing has not changed for a very long time. And the best exposition which I know on that, and it's not for me to lay down what it is or what it isn't, is an exposition given by the Attorney General during our time, then Peter Rawlinson, now the noble Lord Rawlinson, at a speech in September 1972. He went into it in language which is so simple that one wouldn't have thought a lawyer could have written it. And it really sets out the position. It really does set out the position very well indeed on the nature of picketing, which he points out. The only right is that of peaceful persuasion. There's no right to stop a vehicle. There is no right to threaten loss of a union card. There is no right to intimidate. There is no right to obstruct, and numbers themselves can be intimidating. What he also did in that speech was to point out what few other people have pointed out, that each and every person in this country has a right to go about his daily work or pleasure free from interference by anyone else. That right is not being exerted or exercised at the present moment. He also pointed out, and I quote, "The right to proceed about one's lawful business is not in any way subordinate to the right of peacefully persuading. This has always been the case. So the right of a person to do as he wishes should be upheld by the police and by this government." But now we find that the place is practically being run by strikers' committees, and that they're using language such as they are allowing access to food. They are allowing certain lorries to go through. They have no right to prevent them from going through. They have no right to stop it, and they should look to the government and all the agencies of government. Lorry drivers should look to the government and all the agencies of government to protect their right, first, not to stop if they don't wish it, and secondly, to go through to the docks or anywhere else with their loads. That, in fact, is not happening. and it's most reprehensible that firmer steps are not being taken by the government to protect the right of the ordinary citizen to go about his lawful business. Now, there are some very disturbing reports coming through in parts of the country about what is happening. I am getting a large number. I am pledged not to use any names, and therefore I am only... On this side, we respect confidence. On this side, we respect confidence. Of course, the honourable gentleman would like names, wouldn't he?
Can the right honourable lady perhaps tell us how she can reconcile her support for Ford's to settle at any price and for the government not to have any influence over Ford's with a sudden desire now to halt trade unions from carrying out legitimate strike action? And if she has information which she says is confidential,
innuendo.
What value is it if she's not prepared to name exactly
innuendo.
Where and when it's taking place?
At no stage, even though frequently invited to do so, did I support the Ford strike. It was a strike in breach of an agreement. We on this side believe that unions should uphold their agreements as a matter of honour. Gentleman has said. The argument I was developing now is that there is no right to intimidate any citizen in this country. That intimidation is taking place, and I propose to use actual reports from the press in which names are given. They are substantiated by many, many telegrams coming in, and I am not prepared to mention names because that's what a number of people would like me to do, and then they would be exposed to intimidation as well. Reported in the Daily Telegraph today by the animal feed compounders. Very important. I rather thought that everyone recognised it was important for foodstuffs to get through to animals, not apparently the people below the gangway. This is the report. We are finding that essential ingredients, fat, salt and vitamins, are not being allowed through in a number of cases. Not being allowed through. It's a very alarming situation. One Reading feed firm, which is going to be mentioned, was told that its non-union driver would have to pay £16.64, a year's membership subscription to the Transport and General Workers Union, before he would be allowed in to collect animal feed at Southampton Docks. Mr. Charles Cooper, a director of the firm, Walter Parsons and Sons, said, "I think it's blackmail." Yeah. I thought this was a free country. If our chaps want to join a union, they can. We don't see why we should force a chap to join. Yeah. My point is this. No union has any right whatsoever to do that, and I believe it is an offence against the law to do it, and action should be taken to see that lorry drivers are not threatened, that they cannot get through unless they have a union card or take one out. Now, one of the problems about the present law on the nature of picketing is that it is extremely difficult to enforce, and we better recognise that. Intimidation and violence are unlawful. Intimidation and violence, I believe, are happening and are a daily occurrence. And if the present law is unenforceable, then we've got to change it so that it becomes enforceable. The Prime Minister wishes to embark upon that. We will most certainly support him. But when the Home Secretary went on to say that the law has not changed, he was being less than complete in his assessment of the law. The law on the nature of picketing has not changed, but the law on the occasions and places at which it can take place has in fact changed and has been changed by this government. There were, in fact, very considerable debates in this House during the passage of the 1974 and 1976 Trade Union and Labour Relations Acts. This question came up. Hitherto, the position in this country has been that trade unions only have immunities against the law, immunity from the process of law, provided first as a trade dispute, and provided secondly that the immunity only went to a contract of employment. That was all. But that was not good enough for this government. They extended the immunity of trade unions in a very, very vital way. They in fact made trade unions immune in a trade dispute, not only in relation to breach of contracts of employment, but in relation to breach of any commercial contract whatsoever. There were daily arguments in the standing committee upstairs about this. The government was warned what would happen if it did this. There was a long letter from Campbell Adams from in the Times, which was actually quoted during those proceedings. I'm going to quote parts of it today, and I may point out that Campbell Adams was not exactly the staunchest ally of the Conservative Party. He said that if the new Labour government put the change through as was drafted, this is what he said: if the bill is passed as at present drafted, unions will be free in law to black, blockade or boycott, or threaten to do so whenever they like, in respect of a trade dispute anywhere in Great Britain or in the rest of the world. Secondly, it will be lawful to use the picket line for the purpose of establishing boycotts or blockades, whether against an employer in dispute or against employers, companies or bodies which have nothing to do with the dispute in question. The government was warned if they passed that section, it would lead to blacking, blockade and boycott. They were warned about it. That's what they wanted and that's what we've got.
The Honourable Lady refers to the law as it was in 1972. Is she not aware of the picketing that took place at the Saltley Coke Depot, led by Arthur Scargill, which may have been illegal, but which worked from the union point of view, and the law...
Order, the Right Honourable Lady give way to the Honourable Gentleman. He's making a brief intervention.
And despite what laws are on the statute book or what is written on a piece of paper, it does not guarantee that it will prevent picketing.
Member made one of the most revealing and significant interventions I've ever heard in this house. He's not concerned with legality, he's not concerned with protecting the rights of the ordinary citizen to go about his business in this country. He's concerned with the convenience of the trade union. And it's because of that attitude that today many of our citizens are having to apply for permits to a strike committee of the Transport and General Workers Union. That is exactly what this government has landed our people into, and it is totally and utterly wrong. They, in fact, have changed the law on picketing, not on the nature but on the extent, by virtue of that act. They were warned what would happen. It has happened, and they are in large measure responsible for it. They doubtless will. Of course I will. Only too delighted. You're most helpful.
Does the Right Honourable Lady agree? Stop the baying, hounds. Stop the baying, we've not killed the fox yet. Will the Right Honourable Lady agree that she's missed out two very, very important sections of society, the BMA and the Legal Professions Associations, which operate their close shop and, above all, act as their own kangaroo courts, which no other trade union in the country does?
By law.
The Law Society and the Bar Council are not and would not be closed shops. Perhaps... No? No, perhaps the Honourable Gentleman will read the last presidential address of the present president of the Law Society. Of course people have to take qualifications. That is different. Yeah. They do not have to belong to the Law Society to practice as a solicitor. They have to take their qualification. They do not have to belong to the Bar Council to practice as a barrister. They do not have to belong to the British Medical Association to practice as a doctor. I understand from a number of things that the Prime Minister has said on picketing that he doesn't like the present situation either. Now, we don't always judge the Prime Minister by what he says because he does very different things. Most of us didn't like what was happening at Grunwick, but he, in fact, didn't stop two of his cabinet ministers going on that picket line or a number of honourable members. And that was a question of numbers, and numbers themselves can be intimidating. Leave aside the violence altogether. Numbers themselves can be intimidating, and his right honourable friend, the member for Hitchin, and his right honourable friend, the Secretary of State for Defence, went on those picket lines. They were not concerned in the dispute in any way. And will the Right Honourable Lady also tell the House, as a number of her colleagues have not done in letters to the press, that on the moment there was any violence on the Grunwick picket line, which was many weeks after I went there, I immediately denounced it publicly. The Right Honourable Lady was not concerned in that dispute. She was not in dispute with anyone, as far as I know. Nevertheless, she added her presence to the picket line to the numbers, and numbers themselves can be intimidating. But the Right Honourable Lady knows that what I said in my remarks to her were true. Will she now concede that they were true? She concedes that she went on the picket line. I would never, never accuse her of wanting or condoning violence. But I must say to her, she was not in dispute. She ought never to have gone on that picket line. Wait a minute. It encouraged others to turn up in larger numbers. And when one of my honourable friends from behind us tackle the Prime Minister about it at question time. When one of my honourable friends tackled the Prime Minister about it at question time, he said yes, and he hoped that other people, even from our side, would go and join that picket line. So the Prime Minister has not exactly the world's best record as far as picketing is concerned. But we understand from more recent quotations that when he said, not crossing the picket lines become an expression of solidarity to a degree which I certainly did not know in my younger days when I was an active trade unionist. That kind of solidarity, if carried to extremes, means that life could seize up in a closely knit industrial society such as our own. So it seems that he too is having second thoughts. And if he is, and if he will carry out an inquiry and an investigation into picketing, and if he will undertake to first to repeal that extension which his government put through, and then to see both how the law and practice can be changed to see that we do not have the problems we're encountering now, we on this side will support him. Now, very closely allied to the question of picketing and giving it its tremendous power is a very large weapon of the closed shop. It is this which I won't say allows pickets to intimidate, because they're not allowed to intimidate, but which in practice enables them to do it, and we can't catch it and take it to the courts. It is illegal. It is the most powerful weapon. And if you have a lorry driver turning up to a line of pickets, he may well be alone in the cab. He has to face a line of pickets alone. He can be identified because of the name on his, the number on his lorry and the name of it. Then he is so fearful that he's almost bound to stop. As one of them said, "What choice have I? Who will stand up for me when I'm sacked?" Now, again, in this very vexed and vital area of the closed shop, this government has enhanced the powers of the trade unions and has made it legal to have a statutory closed shop, and has made it legal for the unions to see that a person can be sacked from his job without compensation, without right of appeal to the courts of law. That's what this government has done, to enhance and increase the power of trade unions. And when we get the picketing as it is now, and they've enhanced the place where it can take place, when you get the closed shop law as it is now, you have put the biggest weapon into the hands of trade unions for violence and intimidation, which we cannot detect. Now, again...
Would my right honourable friend give way? Would my right honourable friend associate an additional point with the remarks that she's been making, namely that many picket lines are being used not only at Grunwick but also in current disputes for extremist parties like the Socialist Workers' Party and the Communist Party solely as a platform for making political trouble?
I want to get out all possibility of violence on the picket lines. I want to re-establish the circumstances under which people can go about their business without interference and without fear of losing their job. They are in grave fear now. Now, again, the Prime Minister has been saying various things about a closed shop. I mean, he voted to change the legislation, but now he's been saying new things about the closed shop. He said on the 12th of July, "I always took the view that there was a right not to belong to a trade union when I was a trade unionist myself, and I take that view now." Well, if he does, again I say this to him, if he wishes to repeal the legislation which his government passed, we will support him in doing so. If he will bring forward proposals to mitigate the effects of the closed shop, then again we will support him in doing so. If he will ask the unions to minimise its effect, we will support him in that approach. Indeed, it's not impossible to do that. It's just been done at County Hall. Some 17 unions, at the instance of Horace Cutler, have just got a new agreement at County Hall, which means that the closed shop in its present form will not continue. Let me tell the Prime Minister what has been agreed, because it is the biggest breakthrough under the present Conservative government. We would not have the closed shop. A new agreement has been negotiated. Let me read it. If the Prime Minister will get this for every union under all circumstances in the country, it'll be a great advance. Let me read it out. What we've now agreed is that any worker who genuinely objects to trade union membership on the grounds of religious belief or personal conviction can opt out without question. There'll be no Star Chamber type of inquisition into the genuineness of such belief. Any worker opting out will make a charitable donation equivalent to the trade union subscription. That, of course... The present government made a closed shop possible and legal under circumstances when it would never have been possible and legal before, and enabled trade unions to compel a person to lose his job without compensation if he refused to join a union. If the Right Honourable Gentleman will secure by agreement that each and any person who does not want to join a trade union because of personal conviction is able to opt out, we will support him. If he'll undo some of the things he did to give greater powers of closed shop in the 1974 and 76 Act, we will too support him in that. He has a chance. We can see now just whether his saying that he's against the closed shop, there was a right not to belong a trade union, whether he really meant it in the sense he's prepared to do something about it, or whether it was just all talk. If he takes steps to minimise it, we ourselves will support him.
Could the
Could the Right Honourable Lady explain to us whether that agreement that has just been reached with the GLC has been reached now under the existing law as it stands with these trade unions who are apparently supposed to have so much power that they're willing to enter into an agreement of that kind? Is she not in fact undermining the whole of her argument precisely because the trade unions in those negotiations have proved that they're quite willing to enter agreements, providing agreements can be freely arrived at?
Yes, I'm not, and the Honourable Gentleman knows that. I believe passionately that no one should be compelled to join a trade union as a condition of keeping his job.
Yeah, yeah.
The government does not believe that. The government believes and enacted that a person can be compelled to join a trade union. If he doesn't, he will lose his job. That is in the 74 and 76 legislation. And the Honourable Gentleman knows full well that there are cases in British Railways where people who have worked there for years highly satisfactorily lost their job without compensation for the simple reason that this government had passed legislation which enabled that to happen. There are two things, the law itself and the extent to which the trade unions wish to operate it. May I carry on? I am taking rather a lot of time, but I'm not occupying all of it by a very long chalk. And if the Prime Minister will do something to reverse the effect of those two acts which his and his predecessor's government passed, we will indeed support him. Now, the other great complaint which frequently comes is this one. It is, and I believe there's a great deal to it, you cannot have free collective bargaining, and I stress that we've always used the word realistic and responsible collective bargaining. And I will explain the reason. You cannot have free collective bargaining between two sides where there is no true balance of power between the sides. And I believe that there's a great deal to that argument. If you're to be able to bargain freely, there must be a pretty good balance of power between the two parties to the bargaining. That, after all, was why the power of the trade unions was strengthened many years ago when the employee was very much on the adverse side of the balance. Today it's the employer who is on the adverse side of the balance. Yes, I thought we would get that. I thought perhaps I'd... There are many, many cases, although below the gangway doesn't know, when a strike of 3 to 4 weeks can put an employer totally and utterly out of business, and it can scarcely affect the income of those who previously worked for him. And until that balance is a true balance once again, then I believe it will be difficult, if not impossible, to get free collective bargaining. Now, every single freedom, trade union freedom as well, does require very great responsibility in its exercise. And I can see what is going to happen. Unless the Prime Minister is prepared to look at trade union power and really to redress the balance of power so that it is evenly balanced financially and in powers between the two sides, what he is going for will be a state in which you can never get free collective bargaining, but in which he will try to have incomes policies year after year, which in fact will mean that industry in this country seizes up and we never get to a state of prosperity to which our talents and abilities entitle us. Now, there has been a good deal said about pay as you earn. But I might point out the most obvious way to deal with this problem is one, of course, which the Chancellor will never, never take. If you didn't pay so much in tax out of your pay packet, there wouldn't be as much to come back in a strike. Anything like that? Nothing like. But he is the high, the Labour Party is the party of high personal income tax. They love it. They increase it every single time they're in. It has many, many effects. It means that people have no incentive to work harder. And it means, it has another side effect too, they all look at their net take-home pay and demand bigger pay increases than they would otherwise get if they paid, in fact, less tax. Now, there are, in fact, some unions which are so powerful that they are able to deprive the community of the essentials of life. Now, there are some occupations which, in fact, would not go on strike at all. The army wouldn't and the police wouldn't. And we should be very, very grateful to them for their loyalty under all kinds of situations. But surely, are there not also other unions whose work is so essential that one would expect them to be prepared to enter into no-strike agreements? Would it not be reasonable to take them out of the usual processes of bargaining in return for different methods which could be negotiated with them? Yes, I heard someone say water. I know that we went against the Donovan report and took away the limitation on striking in the water, electricity and gas industries. Some of us think that with hindsight, that we were ill-advised to do that. But we did not. The nature of the prohibition was a criminal sanction, which we did not like. Moreover, it had not been used for many, many years, and there was a third reason too, that people get round the strike provision and do go slows or overtime bans. But in fact, Donovan recommended keeping it in to remind people that there were these particular occupations which really were not entitled to inflict immense harm and damage on the community out of all proportion to their numbers. What I'm suggesting to the Prime Minister now is he does enter into negotiations with some of these unions to see if he couldn't get a no-strike arrangement in return for a different method of bargaining which they would find satisfactory. And again, if he does that, we will support him. Now, doubtless, Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister now regrets his attitude to In Place of Strife. And we certainly regret his attitude in 1974 when he pledged to do away with the Industrial Relations Act and to enact new legislation which, in his own words, Labour have already agreed with the TUC. Now, we're concerned with the well-being of all our people. And the question of the powers of unions in relation to the community, Parliament and the law has been raised again by events and by a crisis which even he cannot ignore. And while we're very critical of his complacency, well, we're critical the way that matters have hardened and he's not been prepared to take the requisite action. We're critical of much of his political philosophy. This one matter of trade union power, of taking new laws and new practice against picketing, of releasing the closed shop, and of trying to get more and more secret ballots so that people do not go on strike before they have been consulted about a matter which affects their whole livelihood. If he will agree to take action on these, then we will support him through and through. We believe that this is a matter of great significance for democracy and a free society, and we will support him if he'll take steps to deal with them, and I hope that he will set them in hand soon. May I point out that this is a more generous offer than he ever gave to us when we were in government. I hope that he will take it, and if he doesn't, that he'll step aside for a party that will.